Accession number 19990, reel 14.
Chief Technician Barry Roper, reel 14. You were posted to Odium in July 1963. What was your posting there and what were its functions?
Well, I was posted into what they call the aircraft servicing flight. And here we receive the aircraft from the squadron, do minor or major servicing on it, which would usually take a fortnight or 3 weeks. After the servicing, which was fairly intensive, they'd air test the aircraft, and once it was declared fully serviceable, then it would be sent back to the squadron for the first line people to carry on operating it for training purposes or exercises. But we remained in the servicing flight, and as fast as we got rid of one aircraft, another one was brought in, and we went through the same procedures.
What sort of aircraft were you servicing?
Well, I was on Whirlwind 10s, which was the aircraft of 225 Squadron at the time. They were also in the same hangar, but serviced by different personnel, Belvedere's of 66 Squadron, but they had their own servicing teams in the hangar.
Had you dealt with Whirlwinds before?
Only a brief period, and this was on the Whirlwind 2, which was sent to Cyprus during the Suez crisis. We had this one Whirlwind 2, which I looked after, but that was an entirely different aircraft. It was piston-engined and pretty useless at the time, but the Whirlwind 10, with the Gnome engine, had a greater lifting capacity and all-round performance, and this is why they'd been brought into squadron service. Previously, it was mainly the Navy that used the Whirlwind 2s.
Was the Whirlwind 10 easier or more difficult to service and maintain and look after than the predecessor?
I wouldn't have said it was any more difficult, but being new to the aircraft, it always takes a little while to learn the engine and the peculiarities that you get with the it was totally different to Sycamores or any helicopter I'd worked on previously.
How long do you think it did take before you were fully confident of handling anything that might come up?
About a year. There were always experienced personnel to ask and to explain things to you, and during that year you were often sent away on a manufacturer's course for 10 to 14 days to really learn the thing inside out. But usually you'd gained enough experience before the course came up, and you were, which helped when you were on the course, because you knew the questions to ask. You were sort of improver at training rather than from basic.
Did the Whirlwind 10 have any faults or vices or technical weaknesses that you became aware of when you were servicing it?
Well, the biggest weakness, they were prone to getting FOD damage or foreign object damage. If you sucked in stones or cardboard or anything like that into the intake, it could quite seriously damage the engine, which meant that it had to be stripped down to repair damaged blades on the compressor, and this could be quite extensive if it was a stone that had gone in. In later times, of course, sand ingestion in foreign climes. Our problem at Odium was that they would, if they flew over industrial areas, they picked up soot. And if you had any oil on the compressor, it used to build up, and gradually the performance of the engine was seriously affected. So we had to constantly wash the engines, particularly when aircraft were operating in Germany, over the Ruhr Valley, they used to come back and they were as black as the fire back, and we used to have to clean the engines by with a toothbrush to get the grime and the dirt which was on it, you know.
Scrubbing by hand.
Mm-hmm.
But was this an officially issued toothbrush?
No. I mean, you in the engine bay, they would split the engine, and there you have, it's like a rotating drum with 10 rows of small blades, which range from about half inch in height to an inch and a half in height at the front of the engine. And as you got further down the spool, it got more delicate, till you got to the blades which were only half an inch high, and they could be easily bent or worn. And to get them, normally you wash them with water and kerosene, which got rid of a lot of the oil and grime. But if this didn't improve the performance, we had a thing, without being too technical, called a stall margin, and we used to deliberately stall the engine, and the margin between the engine running normally and stalling, if it was reduced to beyond the permitted level, then the engine had to be changed and hand cleaned when they got it into the engine bay.
You mentioned intake, presumably that'd be the air intake.
Yes.
Did you find that flying over industrial areas produced metallurgical degradation of the component parts of the engine?
No. On the older aircraft, they were made of magnesium alloy. And, of course, operating over a salt-laden atmosphere caused terrific corrosion problems. Later on, as they got the Whirlwind 10 and the higher-powered Gnome, they could change a lot of the skin for duralumin. And this, of course, still prone to corrosion, but we used to have to treat it with the new oil. We used to oil the fuselages with, rocket oil, WD-40, and spray gallons of this onto the fuselage. But if you operated over a salt-laden atmosphere, in other words, like the air sea rescue flights have to do, then the aircraft had to be washed after each flight. And particularly if it had been near the water, hovering, picking up, even training for purposes of picking up survivors, the engines had to be washed on return, and the fuselage had to be hosed down, and then you'd treat it with this rocket oil to try and protect it a little bit more.
Did you have a hazard from bird strike at Odeon?
No, the bird strikes usually damage windscreens and blades on the helicopter, possibly, but I don't think, unlike fast jets, you don't have the same problem with bird strikes. You might have a bird in the intake, but it was a fairly rare occurrence because they were fairly low, slow flying machines.
You were at Odeon, I think, for about 5 years, weren't you?
No. What happened after being in Odeon for, I think it was 2-3 months, in the September, a large exercise was called Triplex West, and it was to support the army in an exercise at El Adam, and the squadron in its entirety went to El Adam.
Was this the 225 squadron, the helicopter
225
squadron?
225 squadron had to supply 8 aircraft for exercise Triplex West at El Adam. We were involved with 38 group, and it was a mobility exercise as to how they would cope if they had a war in the Middle East to deal with. And it was decided that they would attempt to fly 4 Whirlwinds overland to El Adam, and they were flying the Belvederes out overland. And the Belvederes, being a much larger aircraft and able to carry spares, were sort of in support of the four whirlwinds. And so one party, accompanied by the Belvedere, the ground crew flew as passengers in the Belvedere, while the pilots and navigators and probably one crewman flew out in the four aircraft. I, being in ASF, because the squadron would be short-handed, I was put on a party that would break down four whirlwinds, put them into Beverly aircraft on a sledge. The undercarriages had to come off, the heads had to come off, all the blades had to come off, and you had a large sledge which you bolted the aircraft down on. It was so that the fuselage was practically touching the sledge, the bottom of the fuselage, and you slid them into Beverly's. You had to take the tail off, and although there was a lot of work involved, and all the controls of course had to be reconnected once you got the thing out of the aircraft and rebuilt, and so they needed second line support.
How long did it take to actually prepare a helicopter for that sort of movement?
I would say 2 days to load it into the Beverly, and of course when you got it out, 2 to 3 days to rebuild and test fly it and get it back online. So I was, from ASF, not really my job, but I was sent to El Adam. This was around September 1963.
Yes.
We flew out and we arrived at El Adam, and the brief was that we were living outside the camp in a sort of desert area that had been cleared of mines, and that as far as we were concerned, El Adam was 1,000 miles away. We had to support ourselves. So there we were. The Beverleys landed, and the whirlwinds were taken out of the aircraft, and away went the Beverleys. We rebuilt the four machines we had, and air tested them and were ready for the exercise when it began. Unfortunately, the four aircraft that were flying out from the UK had all sorts of problems. They had engine failures which had to be changed. They had a few days at Nice. They flew along. They had a real jolly. And unfortunately, there we were with four whirlwinds to do an 8-aircraft exercise. But in the middle of this, they sent out new doors because of the sand ingestion. They fitted the doors, which had previously just been domes with a grill on the front. They put in sand filters, and the door was much heavier. And it affected the engine performance because of the airflow. And so, in the middle of an exercise, we were changing, I remember changing all the doors, and also we changed, for some reason or other, the IGV actuator, which was quite a complicated exercise, which would probably take 6 hours per engine to do.
What's an IGV actuator?
Well, when the pilot opens the throttle or on the helicopter, the blades on the front of the engine, there are stator blades. We've mentioned the compressor with 10 rows. Well, the first four stages of the compressor, they have what they call stator blades, which are stationary blades between these rotating blades. And the first four stages move. So you've got a linkage, and when the pilot demands more power, this IGV actuator is a piston, a hydraulically controlled piston, which is controlled by fuel pressure. And it moves forward, and it opens the blades to a lesser angle of attack to the airflow. If they're straight onto the airflow, you're at max power. As you close the throttle, these blades turn and reduce the airflow, because it's all to do with airflow through the engine as to what power you're going to get. And it was a bit of a imposition to have to start to do mods in the middle of a sort of exercise where you were supposed to be flying around the clock. And we worked very hard, and we did, I think the exercise lasted for about 10 days, and our poor aircraft were flown intensively because we had to do twice the number of envisaged trips.
What about the effect on the pilots? Presumably they were flying double hours.
Well, most of the pilots were either bad boys or the more junior of the pilots, because the CO himself and all the wing commander flying who was coming out for the trip and all the sort of flight commanders were all in the other aircraft.
Four aircraft.
That were flying overland. Mm. So we were left with, I think it was about three flight lieutenants and a pilot officer, who you usually get on well. The lower the sort of status, the more friendly these people usually are. And we, of course, we had alongside us the Belvederes with a number of master pilots and sort of old hands. The Belvederes, I think, eventually left the four Whirlwinds which were experiencing troubles. They left them behind because they had to be there for
the
exercise.
They had to get on to support you.
So we worked round the clock. Now, the conditions weren't good. The food wasn't bad, but considering we were about half a mile from a good cookhouse and clean tents and so on, there we were living much as we would on Salisbury Plain, in sleeping bags and in sort of, I think it's 250-pound tents, you know. And we had beer, which was one good thing, and there was a lot of esprit de corps, but it was hard work, and tempers frayed with the aircrew, because the lower the rank of the pilot, the more the demands by the army, whereas if you've got somebody with a bit of clout, they can say, oh no, we're not doing that job, you know, this is not what we're here for. But I don't think we were put on all that much.
What sort of jobs were you doing for the army?
The area of the exercise was an old flying boat base at a place called Bomber, and we were mainly moving troops around the, I think it's the Western Desert. I remember seeing the huge cemetery there. I'm not sure, is it Knightsbridge in North Africa, or am I getting confused with Singapore?
There was a position called the Knightsbridge Box.
Well, Knightsbridge, a huge cemetery. And, of course, for us, to see all the tank tracks in the desert from World War II, and boxes of ammunition boxes and flimsies from the fuel and stuff they'd used on the tanks in the desert, it was just as though it was the day before that it had all happened. You'd think the sand would have blown and covered all the tank tracks, but not so. There were all the trenches that the tanks had run in. It was really a bit unreal. Even today, I suppose, you can still see the same thing. And, of course, because it's so dry out there, things don't rust as... there's still armoured cars and stuff wrecked in the desert. And of course, mines. Every night there were mines going up just through the heat of the day. Or camels treading on them and that sort of thing. It was, we were warned that you mustn't go outside the limits we'd been set, or else that was an active minefield. And we got through the exercise, and we were all ready to to go home. So we decided that we'd break the aircraft down, because we knew that the four aircraft that were flying overland were still on the way. And we knew that if we didn't watch it, if we didn't get ours broken down, they'd probably break theirs down and get home before we, who had done all the work. So we broke the aircraft down, put them on the only three sledges or four sledges we had, and the idea was that once ours were broken down, we'd go back to rebuild them. This done, the CO arrived with the other four aircraft, and at the next minute he volunteered them to go and recover so many hundred soldiers from the forward area. Well, we'd already done our bit. The aircraft were our four aircraft were not in very good shape anyway. They, you know, we'd lived with leaks and so on, and they were badly in need of servicing. Everything that could be extended had been extended, and the servicing we'd been able to do in the field wasn't to the standard that you would expect if you had all the facilities. And I can remember they started flying, I think this must have been before we broke the aircraft down, because they were operating about seven aircraft, and they flew up to the bomber area, picked up so many troops, they could probably carry about five or six fully kitted troops. And they were doing this backwards and forwards, and eventually there was a virtual mutiny amongst the pilots, and one would come back and he'd say, I've had enough, and he'd thing, and eventually there were just two aircraft going backwards and forwards, and that was the CO and his right-hand man, and I don't think he was too happy about the situation, but in the mind that the rest of the air crew were in, I don't think he could say very much. And anyway, we broke the aircraft down, the three or four that we were taking back, and then we were paraded, and I've never been on a parade like it. The CO came up and he said, you're not going back to England. This is top secret. Not even El Adam must know about this. Anybody on the station, it is just us. The Hermes has left Far Eastern waters. She should be patrolling in the Far East. She's coming to pick us up at El Adam. The aircraft will be loaded. They'll be taken to Singapore, where they will be taken off and air tested, and the crews will be given jungle training. The pilots will be briefed as to the operation they're going on, and you're going out on a year's unaccompanied tour, or no, you're going out on a detachment to Borneo. The pilots, who were already, particularly the four that had been there all the time, were really demoralised. One pilot fainted on the parade with the news that he'd been given. Another one was sent for psychiatric treatment because he broke down entirely, mainly through the pressures put upon him by the army, by the CO when he arrived, and he just cracked up. So I was all right, because of course I wasn't part of 225 Squadron, I was from the hangar, so really I was just there for the exercise, I thought. Anyway, at the last minute, when it was thought out, there were problems. There were aircraft. The squadron had about 14 aircraft, and we were using eight on the exercise. There were still four in the UK that had been on servicing and so on. And so it was decided that a party from the UK would be flown out to go with the aircraft, our aircraft, which we'd prepared. They would take them on, have them flown onto the Hermes when she arrived, and they would take them to the Far East Some would go on to Borneo, others would be left for training purposes because we were going to be fitted with the Nord SS-11 missile capability of firing these. So we flew back to the UK, and as soon as we got back, the idea was that the bulk of the troops that were going out to support the squadron in Borneo would have some leave and be kitted out with KD and the like.
Jungle gear.
That's right. Right, so because they had the medical problems, I was posted to 225 Squadron.
Who had medical problems?
Well, some of the squadron personnel would either have personal problems, marriage-wise, or medical problems. And so the squadron had to be made up from personnel. Had to be made up from the personnel from ASF that were sort of suitable. And so I was posted to 225, but I also had problems. My wife was expecting a baby at Christmas 63, and my father was dying. And so because the aircraft that had been undergoing servicing whilst we were on the exercise still had to be finished and prepared, it was decided that I would remain behind to take the remaining squadron aircraft on the Bulwark, which was going to sail in April, to replace the Hermes. Now, just a minute, I say Hermes, I wonder if the Albion. I think we should have said the Albion.
The Albion was an assault ship, like the Bulwark, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, that's
ship.
Right. Well, it was the Albion.
Not the Hermes.
Not the Hermes in the previous interview. The Albion was out in the Far East at the time. So, there I was. I had to get my leave in. I was kitted out. And I remained at Odeum, packing away any of the squadron belongings, because we'd just vacated our offices and everything, and it was as though 225 had never existed. The cars, the caravans, boats were all put into our old hangar, the squadron's hangar, and left until we returned, which was estimated to be sort of a few months. It was realised later that this was going to go on for a lot more, and we were there changed to a year's unaccompanied detachment. That was the situation. So my father died, my wife had the baby, the three or four aircraft we had to prepare were prepared. We bought a new aircraft from Westlands, which had been the test bed for the Nord, and I was briefed. I had three men with me. We were to go to Plymouth, where the aircraft would be flown down and deposited on the Bulwark. There was one officer, the gentleman who had had the breakdown after the El Adam trip, was now pronounced fit. And as a sort of rest cure, he was to come out on the Bulwark, but I was instructed as the NCO in charge to bother him as little as possible with any of the problems that I might have.
What sort of fellow was he? Did you know him well?
Oh, yes. He was a South African, a Yarpi, and he was a very, very pleasant chap, easy to get along with. And he... as I say, was officially in charge, but my brief was that he wasn't to be bothered with technical matters, which wouldn't have been his province anyway. And also on the Bulwark, I had my four Whirlwinds, which were put into the hangar, folded up, and I was finished then until we got east of Aden, where I was to make sure that there were certain servicings that were due on calendar time, and certain servicing due on hours flown. And so